Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program. This week my guest is Craig Eisendrath, an author and former diplomat in the US Department of State. After leaving that position, Craig received his PhD from Harvard University, founded an experimental college, and then headed the Pennsylvania Humanities Council. During this period, he co-founded the US Constitution Center, where he was Senior Fellow for International Policy. Craig Eisendrath is currently chairman of the Project for Nuclear Awareness. His books include Bush League Diplomacy, At War with Time, published in 2005, and his recent novel, To Enter Jerusalem. Recently, Craig and I co-wrote the book, War in Heaven, The Arms Race in Outer Space. Craig Eisendrath, thanks for joining us on If You Love This Planet.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Craig, you're an interesting person, so let's talk about how you first became concerned and interested in space. And I think it was when you were working in the State Department.
Well, it was. I was 22, and I got into the United Nations political office. And I was so young that they didn't give me any work. And I sat around for a few weeks, and then a very senior guy left. And they suddenly turned to me and said, "You're in charge of our outer space program."
Oh, my God.
I couldn't believe it. And I worked on it for a number of years because I came back to the UN political office and eventually co-wrote the 1967 Outer Space Treaty.
You co-wrote the United Nations Outer Space Treaty?
Yeah. That was very important because when we first started exploring space, you know, the Russians put their satellite out in October of 57, and we...
Sputnik.
The Sputnik, exactly. And we followed with a klutzy little thing in January of 58. And at that time, nobody knew anything. Like, for instance, we were asking, who owns outer space? Can you claim it? Like, Columbus, you know, for King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, doesn't he say this is outer space, this belongs to the United States, or this belongs to Russia? I mean, these were big questions, and nobody had the answers. So
right.
we were starting from dead scratch.
And so how did you formulate the policy then and the philosophy?
Well, my sense was to de-weaponize space altogether and also make it common territory for all nations. The latter did actually happen, but when I tried to get space de-weaponized totally, I ran into the Department of Defense, and they said that they wanted the option of putting weapons up there, although they would agree to a policy forbidding the orbiting of weapons of mass destruction.
This was way back when?
This was originally, we had these discussions in the late 50s and early 60s.
So they're already talking about putting weapons in space at that time.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, if you check the public Department of Defense research papers, they are researching like crazy to put weapons in space and even talk about nuclear weapons.
That's now or in those days?
Now. Now, with Obama...
Wait a minute, I've got another question before we go on. Of course, even in those days, way back in the 50s, they were using space for nuclear weapons because the ballistic missiles, they're launched from, say, America, and they go up into space, transit space, and then to drop onto Russia and vice versa. So the truth is space has always been, you know, used hypothetically, theoretically for weapons, but not orbiting.
Yeah, it's been used mostly for observation satellites.
Yeah.
And the Cold War, if you look at the Cold War, we had about 25,000 nuclear missiles, and the Russians had about 35,000.
Yeah.
And basically, we were circling the Earth every 90 minutes with our satellites, and so were the Russians. And if we launched, they would know it immediately, and the same, if they launched, we would know it immediately. And that sort of kept the, what they called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction, actually worked until the breakup of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War in 89.
But that still really persists and pertains, doesn't it, that Russia and America still check up on each other, I suppose, spy, and if America launched its 2,500 nuclear missiles now, Russia would know and vice versa. So the situation hasn't changed except the numbers have reduced.
Well, they're somewhat reduced. I mean, we still have, as you know, Helen, we still have 10,000 and the Russians have about 16,000
nuclear weapons.
16,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically they could wipe the planet out if there was a launch. And, you know, in 95, that's after the Cold War, we made a scientific launch out of Norway. The Russians thought we were trying to destroy Moscow, and we came within about 3 minutes of a full nuclear exchange. And if there had been another glass of vodka on the table, it would have been all over.
Yeah, well, that was Yeltsin, wasn't it? Didn't they open the nuclear football for the first time ever in history?
Yes.
Describe to the audience what the nuclear football is, Craig.
Well, we're talking about a basically mutual destruction. If the Russians launched, we would launch, and it would be all over for the planet. And we've never basically reduced our weapon system sufficiently so that we could have a credible deterrent, but not a totally destructive one.
Oh, but you didn't tell us what the nuclear football is.
I'm not sure what that is.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what it is. It's a case that the president of both Russia and America have. When Obama was inaugurated, the first thing they did was hand him this case, which weighs about 70 pounds, and in it are all the codes and mechanisms to initiate a nuclear launch. And there's a man who follows around the president at all times with the football, just in case he needs to start a nuclear war. And when Reagan was shot way back in the 80s, he actually nearly died, but they lost the football for 2 days. They lost it for 2 days. And that's when Alexander Haig, do you remember? He got to the microphones and said, "I'm in charge now." And he really wasn't, but everyone became very frightened. So there was Yeltsin. They picked up this launch of the American missile being launched from Norway, and the Russians thought that America had targeted Moscow. It was about to be wiped out. So for the first time ever, they opened the football, and Yeltsin was sitting in front of it with three generals standing over his shoulder saying, "Press that button, Mr. President." And at the very last minute, because he had 3 minutes to decide, the missile veered off course and it wasn't heading towards Moscow, so they closed the football. And I suppose you're right, because he was a heavy alcoholic. So if he'd had more vodka, God knows.
Yes.
And what really gets me, Craig, is that everyone really ignores this now because the Cold War's over. The Cold War's over. But it's really the hot war now because, as we know, and I want you to talk about this, most of the Russian early warning satellites to tell them whether America's launched nuclear weapons or not, they don't work anymore. Is that right?
That's right. Most of their satellites are so old and so decrepit that they're basically not reliable. You're absolutely right.
So what does that mean then in terms of strategy?
That means we're at risk.
How?
Well, we're at risk for an accidental launch.
How?
Well, let me show you. We've got, between us and the Russians, we have literally almost 5,000 missiles on full alert. That means that these missiles can be launched within 15 minutes.
And the missiles carry more than one hydrogen bomb. They carry up to three.
Yeah, up to three. So we're basically at a hair trigger situation, when in fact our relations with Russia are not that bad. So there's a tremendous discrepancy between our readiness and our political situation. And one of the things which we lobby for when we're going down to Washington, our organization Project for Nuclear Awareness, is to say, look, we don't need this many weapons. They don't need this many weapons. We've got to negotiate down to something reasonable. And then, with confidence, we can get rid of them altogether.
But describe, Craig Eisendrath, how the fact that the Russian early warning satellites, that they're decrepit and not working now, how that makes the situation of mutually assured destruction even more dangerous.
Well, because they're capable of a false signal. You see what I mean? A false signal. They're not attuned to complete accuracy anymore. The Russian space program has been recently revivified, however.
Yeah.
And under Putin, they're beginning to spend much more money for their space program, and I suspect that within a year or two, they'll be back up to where they were some years ago.
Yes. I just want to check one point. 2,500 missiles America has. Does that mean on those missiles, many of them have three bombs, so you multiply that by three, or is it the warheads?
Yeah, there's really, I was talking about warheads, not missiles.
Not missiles, yes.
Yeah, I misspoke.
Just in terms of launch on warning, mutually assured destruction, the missiles and the bombs ready to go now, what path do you think President Obama will follow?
Well, I think what he will do over probably a year or two is reduce, through mutual negotiation with the Russians and opening up that negotiation with the other nuclear powers, reduce our arsenal to about 1,000. I think he will do that. Now, there is...
That's still enough to produce the end of life, most life on Earth.
Yes, but at least it's a start. you got to go down the hill.
Yeah.
There's the START treaty, which goes out of business in December of this year, which reduces weapons to 6,000 on each side.
Mm.
There's the SWORT treaty, the Moscow treaty, which reduces them to 1,700 to 2,200 on each side. That treaty needs to be strengthened, revivified, and implemented. And I think we also need to go into very hard negotiations with the Russians to get the thing down to something reasonable like 50 or 60, which would be more than enough to wipe out major cities and certainly would make the planet more safe, even if it would destroy a lot of lives on both sides.
Well, to put that in context, there are only 240 major cities in the Northern Hemisphere. So if both sides have 50 each, you know, they could knock out half of them. That's obscene, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, the whole thing is obscene. I think it's pushed not by national security interests, but by the industry. We're talking about, you know, Boeing, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, some of the laboratories, you know, that are pushing for these kinds of contracts. And they're spreading literally tens of millions of dollars around Washington to get them.
In lobbying efforts.
Yeah, yeah.
I know when I wrote my book, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex, there's a woman called Jane Nolan who wrote a fabulous book. I can't think of the name of it at the moment, but she said that the height of the Cold War, they were pumping out so many hydrogen bombs, so many, that they didn't have any more things to target. They targeted the railroad crossings, factories, and universities, the whole thing. So junior officers were put in charge of targeting. It was like pin the tail on the donkey. Well, we'll put, you know, another 10 bombs on Moscow. I think there are already 60 on Moscow, actually, as we speak. And certainly 60 on New York, targeted on New York. Yeah. And so what she wrote about, Jan Nolan, was that the senior military officers, let alone the president, never had a say, were not interested in targeting. It was done by junior officers. It was, the redundancy was so extreme.
Well, that's why Obama's really got to take charge and basically make some fundamental reductions. But this is going to require a step-by-step process with Russia and eventually down the line with France, with England, with Pakistan, with India, with Israel, to reduce their arsenals as well.
I know.
Down to zero.
And then we've got hotspots, Craig, in the world. We've got, first of all, got the Middle East with Israel armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, 200 to 400 of them.
Yes.
Which is very much destabilizes the Middle East, which is unstable anyway. Then we've got Pakistan with probably 50 bombs and India with about 65.
Yeah.
And now the new president of Pakistan, I can't think of his name, Benazir Bhutto's widower,
yeah,
was saying that the Taliban could take over Pakistan, and if they did, they'll get those bombs.
Yes, I mean, they've already got, as you know, just gotten control of one of the major provinces. But with Pakistan, it's more dangerous than it even looks, because Pakistan's government is basically decentralized and doesn't have firm central control.
Oh,
and
is that right?
What that means is that units of the army and units of the intelligence system, the ISI, have almost full autonomy. They can control the disposition of nuclear weapons. Some of them are very sympathetic to the Taliban and possibly could smuggle. And then you've got some character like A.Q. Khan running around, you know, distributing nuclear materials and technology to other countries. And he's, as you know, just been let out of house arrest.
Yeah, because he's a national hero. Well, you know, it's like Edward Teller was a national hero, too.
I know, but you see, I think with Pakistan, you've got what Joseph Cirincione calls Pakistan the most dangerous country in the world. And he's right. It is. I mean, it's so decentralized that these kinds of decisions of disposition of nuclear materials and bombs can be made outside of the orbit of the central government. And that's very, very dangerous.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's sort of, you know, when America started building nuclear weapons in the 1940s, saying, well, Russia would never get the secret. And then, of course, Russia did.
Yeah.
And then they tried to limit it just to Russia and America. And then, of course, England wanted to have some, and France wanted to have some, and China wanted to have some. It's inevitable that many more countries get them. And I find thinking so short-term, Craig, when they say, well, this is a stable country, and this one isn't, so they can't have any. When governments change, societies change, and these bombs kind of last forever.
Yeah.
And I find that there's very little of any long-term extrapolation and thinking about who in future will control these things. Do you agree?
Yes. I went to a UN conference in Korea just a few weeks ago, a month and a half ago. In Korea, and I was a delegate, and I was giving a paper, but it was mostly government. And the big question was, how do you prevent countries which are developing nuclear power from morphing into nuclear weapons nations? And the answer, of course, is obvious. You give the International Atomic Energy Agency full power to make intrusive inspections, and you have automatic sanctions if they're violated. But we're not there yet. We have not imposed that kind of regime on the world. So as the number of states multiply that have nuclear power, the real danger of nuclear weapon exchange and so forth grows.
Well, you know, nuclear power plants make the plutonium, which is the stuff of bombs. It's the fuel of bombs, which lasts for 500,000 years. So even still, they're talking about short-term things, not, you know, 100 years from now, 200 years. It's clear to me. It must be clear to those people. There's not the IAEA that's going to inspect countries and make sure they don't move their plutonium from their reactors into nuclear weapons. They mustn't sell nuclear power plants to other countries, and they've got to close the goddamn things.
Well, they should, but, you know, short of that, if there were a international convention which would empower a radically increased IAEA with that type of power, it would be a lot safer than the situation we're in right now.
Yeah, for transitory time. But who knows what the world will be like in 100 years, Craig? We've got now global warming. We'll have, it's predicted, millions and millions of ecological refugees fleeing as the Ganges dries up, the glaciers dry up, the sea levels rise, huge floods and tides flood the whole of Bangladesh and even New York City and the like. You know, Philadelphia could go under. There's going to be...
Do you think Mars is habitable? Maybe we should move.
Yeah, see, that's a facetious remark, but we know
it is.
The human being cannot live in outer space because there's no gravity and our muscles just disappear and turn into tissue paper.
Yeah.
Our bones absorb and become like chalk. Our blood pressure goes all over the place and we become psychotic. Apart from that, it's probably a good idea.
Well, becoming psychotic is something we can do here.
Exactly. And what if some leaders become psychotic and press their button, huh?
Yeah.
I mean,
we're basically in a psychotic situation if you look at it. Here we are with enough weapons times 100 to make the planet uninhabitable, and we have not done anything to reduce this in years. I mean, the Bush administration for 8 years refused to even look at a treaty. They you know, turned down the comprehensive test ban. They wouldn't go for a de-alerting treaty. They wouldn't go for a treaty on the de-weaponization of space. They wouldn't negotiate a treaty on the control of fissile materials. They wouldn't implement our obligations under the CTB. I mean, they did nothing. And they basically said treaties are inimical to American sovereignty, and we should do whatever we feel like. And that was the position for 8 years.
Oh, I know. It was a kind of mass psychosis.
It was crazy.
But what really, really gets me, Craig, is that the American people, number one, and the leaders of the world, you know, in countries, don't rise up and say, what do you think you're doing? You know, there needs to be a sort of global revolution about this thing. Otherwise, you know, tonight, by a press of a button, accidentally, or with a computer error, or someone developing a brain tumor and becoming psychotic and pressing the button before the diagnosis is made, we might all disappear and burn up in fiery hell.
Well, that's why you and I work on this question. I mean, you know, I go, Project for Nuclear Awareness, it's got conferences going all over the place. We're working with people, kids on campuses. We're lobbying. You're doing the same kind of thing. I mean, it's basically vital that we do this kind of thing, but we shouldn't be exceptions. We should be the rule.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I guess we just have to hope and pray for Obama to be so inspired, so powerful, so strong that he takes the nation and indeed the world down the right track for the first time for, you know, probably forever.
Well, he did. I mean, I think the good news, for instance, is he took $50 billion on nuclear development out of the budget.
Did he do that or did the Congress do that?
Well, I think he did it with the Congress. I think there were meetings with the Armed Forces Committees, the Foreign Relations Committee, the Energy Committees, the Appropriation Committees
oh,
between
really?
The White House and the Congress. and that type of liaison created what actually happened.
Yes, and I know that there was tremendous pressure coming from the public. They were faxing, sending emails, telephone calls, letters, the whole thing to members of Congress to take that $50 billion out as a subsidy for nuclear power. So look, Craig Eisendrath, let's move on now to the weaponization of space.
Yes.
You were one of the co-writers of the Outer Space Treaty.
Yes.
Can you tell us from when that was produced in the 50s, banning weapons of mass destruction in space, how space has been used for both commercial, domestic,
sure,
and communicative purposes, and the role that the Pentagon has played simultaneously and in parallel with the peaceful uses of space, and how much space is worth actually financially?
Well, the space is worth literally hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars right now to us and to many of the other developed countries in the world, because we are circulating in space the commercials, the communication satellites, and our entire communication system is now satellite-based. Our entire international weather system is based in space. Positioning, that is, you're in a plane or a ship or in an automobile, you want to know where you are, you go to a positioning satellite and find out. All that's based on outer space, as well as our scientific research. We're discovering that we're not alone in this universe, that we now know, for instance, there are 100 billion galaxies.
100 billion galaxies like ours, my God.
Isn't that crazy?
100 billion.
So all that's based on satellites. And if we start putting weapons in space, we're going to test them. And if we test them, we create debris. Now, you think, well, that's nothing. But, for instance, a 10-pound piece of debris in low Earth orbit is traveling at 17,000 miles an hour. That means that if it hits a satellite, it hits it with the power of a truck, literally a truck. And that's why we can't do it. We can't sacrifice all this investment, all this benefit which we're getting from outer space to put weapons up, even if we don't use them. We will test them. Now, if we use them, of course, space will become totally uninhabitable for our satellites, but it will also be possibly another venue for war, for miscalculation, and then for taking what was going on in outer space and going down to the Earth. For instance, you could see the competition when the Chinese launched, shot down one of their satellites. The next year, we shot down one of ours. You know, we're just...
Oh, it's pathetic.
We're just bristling, waiting for some excuse.
It's just really, really pathetic. It's like little boys in a sandbox, you know. Mine's bigger than yours.
It really is. It really is. But I think what we've got to do fundamentally is get behind the corporate bribery.
Yeah.
Because that's what's pushing this. It's basically contracts. And we've got to really clamp down on that. Now, in Europe, Helen,
yes,
they do something I think very interesting. They make, for instance, media public for candidates.
What does that mean?
Well, that means, for instance, if you're running for office in Europe,
yeah,
you get so many hours free.
Yeah, we do it here in Australia too.
Yeah, but we don't do it in the States, see?
Yeah.
And that means that, for instance, if you're running for Senate, just as a giving example,
mm,
the average cost of running for Senate in the United States is $11 million.
Oh.
I mean, so you say, where is that going to come from? It's going to come from the lobbyists. And they're going to say, you signed this contract, and we'll get you the money, but this contract is going to enable us to, you know, do whatever we want on the military side. And the guy's desperate to keep his job. He says, okay, I agree to that. And that's where our Congress has been bought.
Bought and sold. Bought and sold, bought and sold, bought and sold.
Yeah, we've got to really slap down on this and, one, make it illegal to do this. You know, there are all kinds of ways they get around the very weak laws that we have now. We've got to tighten those laws, and we've got to knock out the fundamental expenses of campaigning so we don't get this kind of situation.
Yes, and also your campaigns are crazy. I mean, in Australia, the Prime Minister announces the election. Admittedly, we've got a different system, the Westminster system, but Prime Minister announces the election 3 weeks before the election.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's intense, you know, publicity, and candidates are chosen for various parties, and they're covered pretty intensively by the media free. There's a bit of money going around, but not much.
Mm-hmm.
Voting is compulsory, so you all have to vote. And it's over in 3 weeks. The fact is that the poor things in Congress, you know, their terms are only 2 years long, and as soon as they get elected, they have to start raising money again. So at least half their time in Congress goes to raising money, like kind of prostitutes.
Yes.
Instead of doing what they're elected to do, is to look after their electorate and govern the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've just raved a little bit now, Craig, but you brought it up.
Can I vote for you for president?
Well, I wasn't born in America, so therefore I can't run like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Let's move on.
We'll alter the Constitution and make it possible.
Craig, let's move on to the debris in space, because a Russian and American satellite banged into each other the other day and
yes.
produced, I don't know, 11,000 more bits of debris. But in how many bits of debris are there now circling the globe in space?
It depends on how small.
Yeah.
I think there's about 12,000 which are big enough to major damage.
Yeah, greater than an inch or something like that. And that's sort of gloves and all sorts of crazy stuff that they drop and lose and...
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we used to sit when we were little looking at shooting stars and thinking how magical it was. Well, now it's probably just a bit of stuff coming down from space burning up in the atmosphere, man-made, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, under Bush, Bush was trying to revivify an older Republican idea of having thousands of microsatellites in space to be used as an anti-missile system. And the microsatellites would swoop down on a missile if it was launched and knock it out. That is literally thousands of microsatellites. He also talked about another scheme, which would be to explode make nuclear explosions in outer space and direct the beams against missiles. Fortunately, the Congress didn't go for it, and it never happened. But for one thing, because the expense of the microsatellite was somewhere between $150 billion and $1 trillion. But lucky for us, because that would have wrecked outer space forever.
In terms of our communication satellites, the weather forecasting,
yeah.
Global commerce, the whole thing.
The whole thing.
Now, so where does the weaponization of space stand now? What's the status, Craig Eisendrath, of the American plans to weaponize space, and who is in charge of it? What area of the military is in charge of it, and what are they doing?
Well, you're right in a transition. The DOD has a major part of itself which has been researching weaponization. They've spent literally tens of billions of dollars over the years researching. just give you another example, anti-missile system has now taken up $170 billion over the years. Of course, it still doesn't work.
Over what years, from when to when? When Reagan first gave the speech?
No, earlier. It started back in the 50s. We started spending money on anti-missile.
$170
billion. $170 billion right now.
And it will never work. We know that.
Well, we know it because if you launch a missile, you can launch decoys. And the decoys can be really cheap, like a kind of a balloon you'd buy in a dime store. And we still, 2009, can't distinguish a dime store balloon from a missile.
Or a nuclear weapon.
Or a nuclear weapon, exactly. So we've got that problem. We've got to now, Obama's got to focus on this stuff and say, look, missile defense is not going to work. Let's drop it and drop the whole business of having a station in Poland and the supporting radar in Czechoslovakia. Drop that kind of stuff and negotiate again with the Russians for a treaty. Now, the Russians, interesting us, as you know, we had a conference on this, the two of us, but the Russians and the Chinese are willing to sign on. That is, they're willing to give this up altogether. And we're the only country in the world that's pushing it.
Missile defense.
Yeah.
Yes. We had a conference on that, you and I, in Washington.
I know. That's what I was talking about. A beautiful one, by the way.
Yeah, that's why we wrote our book. Well, you wrote the book, actually, called War in Heaven.
That's not fair. You're being too modest.
No, I'm not. Now, so let's, you still haven't said who actually, isn't it Stratcom or they've got a new organization within the Pentagon in charge of the weaponization of space and missile defense?
Yeah, it's through the Department of Defense, but I think what we've got to do is basically put those kinds of almost semi-autonomous agencies under strict White House control and start blocking the research. Because as you research things, as you are all ready to go, all it takes is a different president, and you're right into it. And that's very dangerous.
All right. So obviously Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Raytheon are the main corporations doing the research and wanting to make these weapons and bribing the politicians and wanting to put weapons in space. So describe the various weapons that they think are a good idea for space, Craig, and how they would work.
Well, there's about, God, there's literally dozens. One is to send down to Earth a basically heavy object, like that could penetrate bunkers. This is called rods from God. This is something that's been touted around.
Titanium rods.
Yeah, exactly. Another is to arm the satellites with lasers that can hit places on the Earth or hit other satellites. That is making them a laser weapon. The other is to begin to put enough satellites, anti-missile and anti-satellite satellites up that they can actually physically impact and destroy other satellites. Another, obviously, is to arm them with nuclear weapons, which they would then be able to drop on targets. A satellite in low Earth orbit goes around every 90 minutes.
Mm.
You see what I mean? It has the option of dropping something very fast.
Yeah, but there's no gravity in space. You'd have to shoot it down. You'd have to project it down.
You'd have to
have power to do that.
Well, but what's amazing about this, Helen, is that the cost of these weapons is about 20 to 50 times what a comparable weapon on Earth would cost. And we've got them. That is, if you want to hit a target, you don't have to put a satellite up at an incredible cost. To handle that kind of weapon, you launch a missile. We've got the missiles. We don't need the stuff in space.
How much does it cost to launch a satellite?
Oh, God. Hundreds of millions of dollars, really. You know, to launch a very big one. We're talking huge amounts of... Because look at you, you've seen the pictures of what it takes. This huge size of something the size of a skyscraper. It's got to be lifted off the earth. It's got to be built. It's got to be lifted. It's got to be tracked. It's incredibly expensive. And it doesn't give us even any military advantage. We've got all the advantage we need with the stuff on the ground.
We can hit a pin over in Russia.
That's right. Because what we do is we launch something, and it's then guided by satellites which are already in space, and we pinpoint the target. We can hit within, I think it's 15 centimeters.
15 centimeters. Isn't that called circular area probable?
Yeah.
CAP, yeah.
You really got the stuff down.
Oh, I used to sort of pick it up as I went along, thinking how obscene the whole thing was and how absolutely psychotic. I mean, even to say that gives us the advantage, that's a psychotic term. Advantage for what? Advantage for, you know, wiping out Moscow with how many million people live in Moscow now?
I don't know. I think it's 11.
Yeah. I mean, talk about genocide.
I know.
It's sort of been nuclear genocide right from, you know, 1945 on.
That's interesting because the United States is, we talk about genocide, but we've conducted it already. For instance, we dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah.
But we also saturation bombed literally scores of cities in Germany and
Japan.
And often created more damage than the nuclear bombs. And we did the same thing during the Korean War, and we did the same thing in the Vietnamese War. In the Vietnamese War, for instance, we killed 2.5 million people.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
2.5 million.
We saturation bombed the North.
Oh.
I mean, it's scary, and we're willing to do it. We talk about genocide. We're the prime genocider of the world.
I don't know why there is an outrage. First of all, there's a fairly comprehensive lack of knowledge about the history and what all this means and what is happening at the moment. The media just don't write about it too much, except in very technical terms. So Mrs. Joe Green, who goes to the supermarket, Walmart, with, you know, her six kids, she doesn't know about it, and yet, you know, it's a future for her kids or the survival of her kids, and it's just not talked about. It's like as if, I'm trying to think of a similar medical analogy. Well, I suppose it's like, you know, treating a pimple on the patient, on the face of a patient who's dying of metastatic carcinoma.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I mean, if we had the world we wanted, Helen, we'd have this all in the schools.
Yeah.
We'd have this type of knowledge.
Yeah.
The standard knowledge of what's going on, but it isn't. I mean, people get through the American school system with virtually no knowledge of what all this is about.
During the height of the Cold War, when physicians for social responsibility and psychologists for social responsibility and businessmen for social responsibility were really going flat out, curricula were introduced into high schools and into colleges and universities about nuclear war in particular, but also peace studies and the like. But that's all now sort of passé, because I think, you know, when the Berlin Wall came down, everyone heaved a sigh of relief and said, thank God that's over. But it wasn't over. It's not over. And Lockheed Martin, et al. Just keep going and going and going. And Craig, in terms of the current economic absolute global crisis, where things just collapse day by day by day by day, and knowing that in America the tax dollars, over $1 trillion, if you count all the black budgets and the like, are spent on the Pentagon, over $1 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, you could transfer a huge amount of that money to maybe form a nationalized medical care system for the American people so everyone gets good medical care. I mean, it's sort of sticking out like a sore thumb, and yet rarely talked about. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And you look at our foreign policy, which is almost entirely war-oriented.
Yeah.
And we're, as you say, we're spending somewhere between $700 to $1 trillion on military. Do you know what our foreign aid budget is?
No.
It's $15 billion. That's all. It's 0.16% of our GNP. It's
yeah.
literally one quarter of what we pledged ourselves, you know, at a conference a few years ago when we said minimally we'd give 0.7. We're welching on our agreement. And meanwhile, for instance, 10,000 people are dying every day of starvation in sub-Saharan Africa. And we talk about being, you know, a Christian or a Jewish nation or whatever, you know, and, you know, himself said what, you know, the rich man goes to himself and says, what do I have to do to enter the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus says, you got to give away your goods to the poor.
Yep.
Yeah, and we don't honor those things. We don't honor our own ethics. And I think that's serious.
I do too. And I think that money has become the god. And then look where it's led. You know, it's so funny to look at the economic crisis. In fact, the whole economy was built on a house of cards, and one sort of puff of a wind when things started to go wrong, the whole thing collapsed. It's amazing, isn't it? Poor old Iceland, it's bankrupt.
Well, I think we're still, you know, it's funny. Psychologically, we're back to Adam Smith. Adam Smith writes his Wealth of Nations, and by the way, interesting year, 1776. And basically, he says, go out to make money.
Did he?
And
I haven't read
it. Yeah, he says, go out to make money, and everything will be fine. Don't worry about the social value of what you do. Just go out to make money, and you'll find out that the public will benefit because prices will go down by competition till it's marginal. Everybody will benefit. Turned out to be not true. And it turned out to be that mindset of just not worrying about the social impact of what you're doing is what's wrecked us over the last couple of hundred years.
Yeah, that's Milton Friedman too, isn't it, who was from the University of Chicago. That was his ethic too.
Yeah, but that's right. That was the... you're right, and they loved Adam Smith.
Did they? The Chicago
Milton Friedman did. He worshipped him. That was his god.
Here's another philosophical question, Craig, which haunts me in a way, because the modern economy, globalization and all the rest, is built on growth. Growth, growth, growth. And when 9/11 happened, George Bush said, fly and buy, fly and buy, fly and buy. Well, now we live on a planet with finite resources, finite air, finite water, finite minerals, finite forests, and the like. There will be a point, and we're getting to it now, oil, where those resources are not there anymore. And so we can't have an economy built on perpetual growth. If we can't have that, and we've got all these people in the world, 6.72 billion now, when 200 years ago there were only 1 billion of us.
Yeah.
Have you thought about this, Craig, and thought what, in a sensible way, how the world can survive without this perpetual growth and a need for more and more money? How are we going to, will we go back to a bartering system or?
You're absolutely right.
What are we going to do?
Oil has peaked already.
Yeah.
The production of oil has peaked.
Yep.
And the demand for oil is up and up and up. I mean, that's a good example, but just is a footnote to what you just said. But the big question is, what's to be done? I think what's to be done is something like this. We've got to look at the needs of people and be able to meet them. And we've got to be modest. We've got to deal with the fact that the discrepancy between the very rich countries like ourselves and the rest of the world, we have to be willing to go down to some extent in our standard of living. And we have to then create not wealthy. I mean, let me give you an example. We used to have something called the progressive income tax in the United States. And this started in the country, actually, way back in 1912. People don't realize that, but it goes back that far. The progressive income tax has almost disappeared. And we basically, if you talk about sales tax and so forth, poor people are paying more taxes than rich people. We've got to go back to a system where the poor are paying proportionally taxes, and the rich are paying much more. Yes, and they've got to be willing to accept a considerably lower standard of living than they are. And then I think if we do that, if we begin to go for adequate rather than luxurious, then I think we can live. And by the way, if we begin to do this, you'll find what happens in Europe. For instance, in Europe, the population is actually steadily going down.
Mm.
You see what I mean? Because of taxes and because of the kinds of benefits that people are getting and so forth. We've got to get to a situation not only in the United States, but also throughout the world, where there's sufficient prosperity that people are now willing to see a family of not seven, but less than two.
Yeah.
That's where we need to go. And it's doable.
It is doable. And with that wonderful philosophical cadenza, let's just end with the last question, which will bring us full circle back to the topic we originally talked about, which is the weaponization of space. Apart from America wanting to put weapons in space and fight war from space down to Earth, are there any other countries who want to do the same, Craig Eisendrath?
Well, I think you've got China. I think you've got Russia, which would do it defensively, but would do it. I think, interestingly enough, when they get the technical capacity, North Korea would like to do it. I mean, I think there's a danger that if we don't act, that more and more countries will be in a position to do it, and will do it somewhat defensively, but they will do it.
A space race.
We still got a chance.
Yeah.
To de-weaponize space, and it's got to be done in the next year or two.
Well, thank you very much, Craig Eisendrath. And if people want to learn more about this incredibly interesting and provocative topic and then do something about it, read the book War in Heaven, The Arms Race in Outer Space, published by the New Press in 2007 by Craig Eisendrath and by me. And you'll have all the basic knowledge that you will need to educate your elected representatives and to lobby President Obama, because he wants to be a president of, for, and by the people. That's how he got elected. And I think we have a very excellent opportunity now to really move in and do the right things for the world. All it will take is some extra energy. Right, Craig?
Yes, and I do want to say that you are the best interviewer I've ever had on radio.
Oh, that's very
you
sweet.
You get the Legion d'honneur, premier class.
That's very and sweet.
And a French general with a perfume mustache will pin the medal on you.
Well, and you were an excellent interviewee. I just love the topics we can engage in, Craig, together. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet is Craig Eisendrath, former diplomat in the U.S. Department of State and co-author of War in Heaven, The Arms Race in Outer Space.
I was playing a club by the Eiffel Tower, taking a break for half an hour. A girl from the bar came out to talk, and while she said, let's take a walk. Monday was the day we met. Tuesday I was flying. Wednesday she was far away. Friday caught me crying. we talked and we laid on the bed. And I can remember every word she said. Never met a girl like that before. Every day I miss her more. Monday was the day we met. Tuesday I was flying. If I ever see that girl again, I'm gonna tell her that I love her. If I ever see that girl again, there'll never be another, I know. Monday was the day we met. Friday caught me crying. I know we'll be flying.
Fly,
fly. I think about you.
That track was Flying by Chris Isaak. That's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us on If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott. And just to clarify, there are no weapons in space at this time, but they're working very hard to launch weapons in space, to design them, to produce them. So just be aware it can be stopped, and it's really up to you.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.